Session number 16909.
Anscombe Mill 3.
And they took us down to the harbour, and Lady Luck was with us. They put us on the deck. And there were just Mick Levy and myself, and I think it was three long-range desert group chappies. Unfortunately, when we were captured, Corporal Weissman and parachutist Plotnik, we never saw again. They disappeared as though in thin air. We never saw the going or anything of them. We made quite a few inquiries as we came further back to find out, but up until this day, I have no recollection or idea what happened to those two. Well, in the harbour again, on the boat, and we're sitting on the side of the hatch, and all of a sudden, a seaman came running round from the other side, and his mouth was wide open. He couldn't speak. All he was doing was pointing. Well, unfortunately for one of the Long Range Desert boys, he jumped up on the hatchway and looked to where the seaman was pointed, and he said one word, torpedo. And at that precise second, the torpedo hit the boat, the hatch went in, and our poor friend disappeared into the boat. We straight away started jumping up onto the tanks that was on the deck and took our desert boots off. And Mick Levy, as he told me afterwards, I didn't realise at the time, he noticed that the boat on our side of the lifeboat on our side of the boat or ship hadn't, was undamaged. And he ran up onto the bridge, jumped into the lifeboat, picked up the axe out the bottom, chopped the ropes, and the boat dropped into the sea. He never even got his bloody feet wet. I, in the meanwhile, had taken my boots off, climbed up onto the rail, and by then the boat was well over on one side. I ran as fast as I could down the side, jumped and struck out, and started swimming. In the meanwhile, the boat went down, and the first voice I heard was Mick Levy shouting out for me. And I stopped swimming and looked, and there was Mick in the boat, rowing it around. Well, we picked up the other two Long Range Desert Group boys, and Mick and myself. We got into this lifeboat and we started rowing it, because we was only about, we couldn't have been more than half a mile out of from the coast. And naturally, we started rowing for the coast. But in the meanwhile, an Italian sloop that had supposed to escort us, he came back and he fired a shell across the top of us, and we drew the oars in. They came alongside in a motorboat, put us onto one of these rafts, and they went round picking up the Germans, and then they collected us afterwards and took us aboard the sloop. And you can imagine, I hadn't had a wash, a shave, or a change of clothes for the best part of 3 months. So, and then what with the diesel oil, when the boat went down, I was in a right state. Well, they took my clothes off and they dried them all off. And you couldn't wash, there was no facilities there. So I'd sort of dried myself on a couple of towels they gave me, and I put my clothes back on, and they took us back into Tunis, and we waited a couple of days, and they took us down to a small town outside of Tunis called Bizerta. And as we arrived there, we saw these Junkers 52s on the ground. They took us to one of those, and they put the four of us, and we had 10 guards and an officer in charge. We jumped onto one of these Junkers 52s, and straight away, they didn't wait anymore, straight up. And our chappie flew, as they all did, over the top of Tunis, and then dived down onto the Mediterranean. Apparently, they used to get down as near to the water to stop our fighters getting behind them. Our silly so-and-so hit the water, and away went the undercarriage. And Mick and I are saying to each other, right, we're saved again, we'll be back. But he didn't. He came on the intercom and he said that he was flying on to Naples, and then he'd make a crash landing at Naples, which he did. And we flew round and round, and we could see him putting all the stuff on the runway, and then he suddenly came on the mic and he said, I want you to climb as high up the sides of the plane as you can, because I'm going in to crash land. And in we came, and the size of that plane, it got smaller and smaller every foot we travelled along that runway. And by the time that plane swerved to a stop, I don't think it was 4 foot tall inside the plane. The doors were flying open. As soon as it swerved, I said to Mick, jump. And we jumped straight through the open doors out in case it caught light. But that was it. They then marched us from there to Naples town, and they took us into the marvellous hotel right opposite the station at Naples, and they took us right up to the top floor, and they took us into a suite of rooms that were absolutely palatial. And as I said, the state we were in, there was a bath and everything in there, but they wouldn't even let us wash. And they made us get into these beautiful white beds as we were. Needless to say, we didn't need much rocking. Within a couple of minutes, we was out cold. And in the morning, up we got, and the officer told us that it was his job to transport us to Dulag Luft, which is the Air Force place in Frankfurt on Main. And he said, if we would give our words as English gentlemen, that we wouldn't try and escape between there and Frankfurt, he would give us all the beer and cigarettes that we wanted. Well, the condition we were in, and me having no boots in any case, I'm remembering that now it was into February, which was winter in Europe, and we'd just come from the desert, we were feeling the cold. And we said, yes, okay. And they really looked after us on the train, and the Germans that were on the train coming home on leave, and they treated us as you would do each other. We were soldiers, and they treated us as soldiers. And I found with the German soldier that they treated you as men. And after spending 3 or 4 days in Gulag Luft and smoking more Players medium than I'd seen for years, what the Germans offered us, then we were transferred to Stalag 8B at Lambsdorff.
Did you have interrogation at Dulag Luft?
Oh yes, they came in, but it was the usual stuff. What job was you on, and where was your depot, and what were you doing? And but it was just sort of routine stuff that you didn't know. Sorry, I don't know. When it came to what were you doing and where you were stationed, we just said in Africa. And after 2 or 3 days, we were just taken to the main camp.
Did they put any unpleasant pressure on you?
Not nastily. You got the awkward squad who liked giving you backhanders. I got a few thumps with rifle butts but that was mainly after we'd come out of there and gone into the main prison camps. The actual fighting men, the German fighting men, treated you what you were. You were men. But it was the backroom boys that, and when we came up against the Gestapo and people like that, they tried to be nasty. Although, again, there, usually if you had a fighting man escorting you into town for anything, say a visit to the dentist or the doctors, and you came across these Gestapo boys, they soon told them where to go. They're nothing to do with you, the German soldier used to say to them. They're under our charge, the Wehrmacht. And I'll give them their due, they used to whistle them off pretty sharpish, but if they got the opportunity, if anything happened at a working party, you know, naturally we did little jobs to break things and cause a bit of sabotage, and they might come down visiting, and then they got a bit heavy-handed, but it wasn't anything that you couldn't get by with. They'd give you thumps. I mean, that's the only war wound I've got behind my ear, where one of them hit me with the butt end of a rifle. But, you had to grin and bear it. And that was it.
So you went to Lambsdorff?
Yes, 8B. And then we'd been there, wasn't all that long. I got fed up with Lambsdorff. There was nothing to do. And so Mick and I decided that we'd volunteer to go out on working parties. We'd get more chance of nipping away and things like that. Although, once we realised exactly where we were and how far that you had to go to regain our lines or get away was totally out of the question. And we just settled down to it. And our first job was working at a sawmill. And there were about 25 of us in this little working party, and I got selected to be the boy who did the not the interrogation, but to find out what we could get in the way of food and things like that, what we could scrounge off of the different workmen or the even the guards. And we started to do quite well then, and I used to barter with them with chocolate, what we got in our food parcels, and tins of cocoa, the things that we didn't really enjoy. I mean, not many of the Englishmen loved their cocoa. We used to swap it for eggs and bread, and that used to bolster up our food for the week. And we went into a little combine where we used to, four of us used to put our four parcels together, and that's how we got through. And but when you're in a place like that, everything has to be done straight. So what we used to do, if I was cook and I dished up four meals on four plates, we'd have four kings and four queens. The four kings would shuffle up and we'd put one on each plate, and then we'd shuffle the four queens up and each one would draw one. And they'd match them up and that was your dinner. So that there was no suggestion at all that you've got a little bit more to eat than your mate. And that's the way we did it. I mean, it sounds stupid now, but when you're in that position, it means a lot. And so that's the way we used to do it. We'd get our bread ration between four, and you had to cut it up into four pieces, and we'd operate that just the same, and each one of us would take it in turns in cutting up the bread into four portions. So there was no question whatsoever of anybody fiddling a little bit more from anybody else. And it used to work pretty well. And at the sawmill, I volunteered to go out into the woods. And there were four of us. Needless to say, Mick was alongside of me. And we got the wood job. And our job then was to go out on the tractor first thing, take the empty trailer, and we used to load the pine trees onto this trailer. And when we'd loaded as much as the driver thought was enough, he would connect up and tow that back into the sawmill and then bring the empty one out. Well, the first day we said to the chef in charge, how many loads do you want for the day? Oh, I want about 10. And I said, you'll be lucky. And the first day we did four. And we worked all day. So the second day, we've got to add more than that. Well, be reasonable and we'll see what we can do. I'll cut it down to eight. So we did five that day. Oh no, we've got to do more. So we said, well, be reasonable. Well, we got him down to six a day. And we got our postman, who used to come out with us, he used to be the four POWs, the tractor driver and the postman. So we took our own coffee, the real coffee, out with us into the woods, and the thing to boil up. So what we used to do, we said we'd get it organised. We said to the postman as soon as we got out, get the fire going. Well, being as it was winter time, you were allowed to light fires. So you get the fire going, get the water on, and we load a couple of loads and get it sent in, and then back had come Hans on the tractor, and by then the coffee was boiling. We'd pour out the coffee, And in the Canadian parcels, we used to get a big packet. They were called water biscuits. And we'd got to the stage where we could split these in half and toast them. And we used to give one to the guard, one to the tractor driver, and that was wonderful for them, and a cup of real coffee. And we had our own milk, because we used to get the tin milk in the parcels. And straight away, that brought us in. The old guard used to come out, and he'd say, I've got a loaf for you today. And of course, their loaves of bread were great big round ones. And he'd give us that. And the tractor driver, we used to say to him, now, come on, Hans, you live on a farm. What about some eggs from you? And we got him organised. And he used to fetch us in half a dozen eggs at a time. And we was laughing our heads off after a little while. We were sorry when we cleared that forest, because we got shifted then.
And right, carry on.
And they shifted us to a place that was, the first one was E225. I can't remember. Oh, E79 we went to next, I think it was. And there was a, where our lager was, it was especially built for us. And we had a few more RAF boys came with us. And there was about 40 or so of us there. And it was a very nice, clean place, specially built for us. And alongside of it was where another building where the guards and the cookhouse were. And naturally, they didn't give us a lot of good food, but we were still getting our parcels through. And this one, about 300 yards away from where our building was, there was a beautiful lake. Well, by then the weather was warming up a bit, and we had a word with the under officer in charge of the site, and how about going to swimming when we wasn't at work of an evening and weekends. And at first he said no, but we used to get an issue of French cigarettes. So our parcels were coming through pretty regular then. And so we slipped him a few packs of French fags, and that was it. That got us swimming. And our job there, apparently they wanted to make a canal from this big lake, which was at the top of this hill, down to the canal that ran right through the local area where they used to bring their supplies along. And our blokes, apparently somewhere on that canal, they were continually bombing it, so that the water was running away from the canal, and they wanted us to build this sort of semi-canal to run the water from the lake down into the original canal. Well, we messed them about a bit there.
You mean sabotage?
Yeah. I got the job. Because I could start this machine that used to... They'd fixed a railway from down in this valley up to the top by the lake, and they put one of these winches there, electric winch. And they had these little tip barrows that we used to run half a dozen or so down on the railway. And because I could start this machine, I was called the machinist, and I was put on that. And the boys used to fill up these tubs where they was digging the earth out, and they'd give the okay, and I would start the winch to draw these, all the dirt up. And the little so-and-sos, as I was drawing it up, they'd put their pick handles and shovels under the wheels until they was off the line. And I wasn't supposed to notice it until all of a sudden one of them would go over, and then next thing, all of them were upside down, off the line. And we used to argue amongst each other then, that's the Germans and me. I'd say it's not my fault. If you can't lay the line straight so that the wheels stop on them, how can we pull them up? And that went on for days and days and days. Well, then they decided they'd got this valley dug out, and they decided they was going to bring up barges full of sand and bags of cement to mix up to line this canal with. And I used to say to the lads, being a machinist, I got the job of driving the little train. And they used to connect up about three wagons, and they'd put all the bags of cement in. And I said to the Germans, now make sure it's connected right. I'm not being blamed if it comes off the line or the pins come out. And he checked me and he'd say, I'm sure they're all right, Albert, you pull away. And I had a bit of string that I'd attached to the one that connected up to the engine. And by pulling this string, I could just ease this pin out. And out of each barge of cement, I think that we lost 100 bags into the canal where I used to pull the pin up, so that the what's names, instead of riding up nicely, start to tilt. And once you've got the weight enough for them tilting, away went the bags of cement, straight out and in the drink. And then I'd let the pin drop back again. And we were very good at that. And then of a night time, when the lads had cemented it again, it was still frost and that about, and the old Jerry used to get us to put these big sheets over the cement that we'd laid that day, and we'd have to put bricks on it to hold it down in case the wind blew it away. And the boys had laid their stones so that at the first puff of wind the old sheets was up. And many a time we come in the morning and the sheets have all gone, and there's the cracks in the cement where it had hardened, so we had to redo that lot again. And after working there for quite a few months, they decided we were bad lads, so we were sent to E51, another working party, which was a coal mine. And we started there, and there we had to work 7 days a week, and we used to get one Sunday off a month. That was for all your do all your entertainment, football and whatever, on that one Sunday. And we had an English doctor in charge, so there were about approximately 500 of us at this site.